Everyone has their own unique views and needs when it comes to financial success. If you'd like to leave your financial woes behind and live a life of financial freedom, you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Saving with Steve Show, hosted by Steve Sexton. The show will help you with the ins and outs of money. We talk about financial issues that could be costing you thousands of dollars and keeping you up at night. We talk about money, tax reduction, saving more, spending less, 401ks, risk management, retirement, and everything under the sun that relates to you having a healthier, happy relationship with money. Now, here is your host of Saving with Steve, Steve Sexton.
Hey, welcome to the Saving with Steve Show, where we talk about the ins and outs of money, pretty much everything in the sun relates to you having a happier, healthier relationship with money. My name is Steve Sexton. I want to thank you for joining us today. Big time thanks for you sharing with your friends, family, and associates. We're well over the million listener mark, so we're very, very happy with that. But folks, it's Financial Planning Month. Today we have Billy Spencer. He's a certified financial planner, a certified financial behavioral specialist, and he's here to help us. You know, why do people do those things financially? Help us with practical steps for planning, how to develop money mindsets, and you know what, the big mistakes people make to separate their money from their life goals. So, Billy, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be on. Appreciate you having me.
That's great. You know what? Here, one of the big questions we always like to start with, because everybody likes to know a little bit of a backstory. So, sure. What got you to become a financial planner?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I always liked numbers. And so my background was in business and accounting. And I started out there. I really missed like the human part of interacting with people. Like I was getting my fill of the numbers, but I missed the human aspect of it. And speaking around and networking, I found myself ending up talking to a lot of financial planners. And so I switched careers from an accounting background into a more financial planning background about 10 years ago. And really, you know, got to be able to talk to people and use numbers at the same time, which is what got me here today.
Okay. So, you know what, everybody knows what a certified financial planner is because they seek those people out, but not too many people knows what a certified financial behavioral specialist is. So what's that? Help me with the designation, what it does for you, what it does for the people you work with and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. So I'll start that out by telling like a little story, which is
perfect
out of my background a little bit too. So as I mentioned, like I was coming from an accounting background and I started working more with people. I took the CFP exam. I knew all the things. I thought that, okay, you know, all I have to do is tell people, here's the advice that you need and they'll follow through on it. What I quickly learned is that is not the case. It's a lot more nuanced than that. Because you are working with human beings and everyone's sort of coming to the table with different levels of knowledge as it relates to personal finance and investing, their own different backstories around money and how they grew up around money and what they were bringing to the table. And what makes that even harder is like when you have a couple, because then there's two people that are coming to the table with potentially two different backgrounds and stories. So during the pandemic, you know, people remember that there might have been a little bit more time to kind of do things when we weren't able to kind of go out and see the world and all of that. So I wanted to figure out how I could, you know, become a better planner by understanding the human element of finances at that point in time. So I ended up doing a master's program at Kansas State University, which was in, you know, financial psychology and financial therapy. And really, like, I say all of that to say what a financial behavior specialist is it's a lot of different things, but the way that I think about it is, you know, you've got the financial planning element right here, I'm going to speak in Venn diagrams, and then you have the human side of it. And so the financial behavior specialist kind of lives in the middle there. We're combining, you know, the person with the financial plan itself and then making better advice from that.
Oh, okay. So that basically helps everybody through so you can communicate better and they can, whoever receives the advice can understand it more and help them get to where they need to go. That pretty much the size of it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think even the CFP board, for instance, like who has the CFP designation, they've actually added the psychology of financial planning to their exam. In 2022, I believe it was, and it's now 8% of the exam. And so people are recognizing like this is more important. I think mental health in general is sort of like coming more to the forefront than it has been in the past. And so I actually wrote a paper on this that's in the Journal of Financial Planning about the pain points related to the psychology of financial planning. And one of the biggest things was like behavior change and helping people sort of like move beyond just simply writing down the budget, but actually doing something with it, which is, you know, really what this training has helped me to do with the budgeting example and everything else.
Okay. So I want to start with the mistakes people make that separate their money from their life goals. And then let's talk about how to fix it. Because you know what? We see people, there's so many people in the United States that aren't adequately prepared for retirement. They don't have enough money saved in case of emergencies. And a lot of that is just choices.
Yeah.
I've met people who didn't make very much, but they're really good at saving. And now they have, you know, well over $1 million. They're still not spending anything, but they have more than enough to take care of themselves. It's just that they've created that mindset and stuck to it. So let's talk about that a little bit. Hey, what are the mistakes people make? How did it affect them? And you know what? Let's talk about how we can fix it.
Yeah, and going back to your example of the person that had saved diligently over their lifetime and they got to retirement, and they weren't necessarily very good at actually being retired itself. I think that's an important thing that, you know, we really need to start thinking about when we start thinking about saving and budgeting and all that sort of stuff is like, what are we actually doing this for? Because with the absence of that, we're not necessarily like understanding what it's going to look like in the future. And so what I encourage people to do is actually think about that as the starting point to say like, okay, you know, if even like we'll start small, right? Like if it's a year from now, and you know, a future me a year from now in 2026 is thanking me for something that I did today, what is that thing? What have I done? And then that can sort of break down the steps to, you know, much smaller pieces that I can work on over the next year. Similarly, like with retirement, like for some people that could be really far out in the future. And it's almost like we don't even know what that looks like because it is so far out in the future. And so we have to start sort of thinking about what is it that I want? And then how do I use money as a tool to sort of achieve it versus just making money as the thing like, okay, I'm just going to make the pile as big as I can possibly get. And then when I get there, I'll figure it out later. It's actually work it a different way where you say, okay, I want to do this. And how does the money fit into that?
Okay. So in other words, if it's one of those things where you're thinking, okay, in the next year, I've got to save for this house. So that's my end goal. How do I go about doing it as opposed to just saying, I'm going to make as much money as I can. You'd look at it and say, hey, just for example, I'm assuming this, here's my budget. Here's how much extra I have. Here how much I can put away towards saving for that house. Is it something like that? Or could you get a little more, could you give us an example?
Yeah, sure. So I'll, this is more of, I'm going to tell a story with the example, but
please.
This is somewhere, you know, someone, you know, let's say they're earning, that they're able to save, they have plenty of room for saving. They go and talk to a financial person and they say, oh, you know, you should be doing this, like going and buying this house, and you should be doing this, like moving outside of the city, and you should be doing this for that. If that person went and acted on that, they may not actually start to implement some of those changes only because like they're not really what they want to do. It's more of like somebody should that on them and said that you should be doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you flip the script around and talking to that person, what I might uncover is that, you know, what they really like is, yeah, they love the ability to save, but what's underneath all that is they really enjoy the flexibility of just having additional funds so that they can travel all the time. And they do not want to be tied down by having like a mortgage in that instance. And so, you know, when somebody tells them, oh, you should be buying a house because that's where you're sort of at in this stage of life, and they don't want to be doing that sort of thing because they actually want to be enjoying their money and have the flexibility to travel more and not be tied down to a mortgage. Like that's the sort of approach that I'm taking, is where you kind of figure out what you want and then use the money to get there.
Okay. So in other words, you're finding out what's important to somebody, the whys behind it, and then doing the planning through the lens of them as opposed to those expectations that others have put on them or those shoulds that other people put on them.
That's exactly it.
Okay, perfect. Now, what other things that people do when, you know, making mistakes with their financial planning or their financial money management?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there's, you know, I could really go off into different areas of it. I think another thing is around awareness. Because think about an interaction during your day that doesn't that doesn't actually have money attached to it. Like money sort of is like intertwined into our lives in so many different things. And so, you know, when people are creating budgets or thinking about like, okay, I need to be saving this, and you know, oh gosh, like, you know, I overspent this month on that. Like what's not happening is potentially like just creating awareness of what's been going on. And so, you know, for instance, if somebody goes to the grocery store these days, I mean, I can go and tap my watch and pay for something and not even know what I paid for it and just walk out of the store. And, you know, there it is, you know, it shows up in my credit card statement and I barely look at that. What I like to think about though is just creating like a pause when interacting with money, where, you know, if you go to the grocery store, you go to pay something, just note, like, you know, tap your card, just notice what happened there. You know, what went through your mind? Or, you know, if you are shopping and, you know, you're saying like, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this sort of thing. Like, what was the sort of thing that happened before you went shopping that sort of got you in the position to actually go shopping? Like, what, were you feeling hungry? Were you sad? You know, were you feeling lonely, tired? You know, all that sort of thing. So just creating more awareness around how you interrelate with money can be a really beneficial thing that can help you improve, you know, your finances, because that awareness then helps you figure out like, okay, what is it, like I said before, what is it you want to do with your money? And then how do you use that as a tool to achieve that?
Perfect. Hey folks, stick with us. We'll be right back with more Billy Spencer and Saving with Steve.
More expert advice for having a happier relationship with money still to come on the Saving with Steve show.
Don't let your financial woes keep you up at night and prevent you from living a life of financial and personal freedom. Hi, I'm Steve Sexton, host of the Saving with Steve show. We're going to be talking about the ins and outs of money, those financial issues that could be costing you thousands of dollars, causing stress, keeping you up at night. We're going to talk about money, tax reductions, saving more, spending less, your investments, risk management, retirement, and everything associated with you having a healthier, happy relationship with money. So if you've ever dreamed of living a life of financial and personal freedom, you owe it to yourself and your family to tune into the Saving with Steve show. Join me, Steve Sexton, on the Saving with Steve show as we talk about everything under the sun when it comes to money. To learn more about the show, visit savingwithsteve.us. That's savingwithsteve.us, savingwithsteve.us. We'll see you soon.
Welcome back to the show that is here to help you achieve your financial goals. It's the Saving with Steve show. Now here's your host, Steve Sexton.
Hey, welcome back to the Saving with Steve show, where we talk about the ins and outs of money. Pretty much everything in the sun that relates to you having a happier, healthier relationship with money. By the way, folks, all the replays are available here on savingwithsteve.us. If you're enjoying the stories of helpful insight, information on Saving with Steve, I encourage you to subscribe to our YouTube channel and check out a few of our affiliates at UK Health Radio, BBS Radio, Talk Radio New York City, E360 TV, Las Vegas TV networks. All these networks are dedicated to empowering you to solve problems, uplift your spirit, and live a life of personal financial freedom. So, hey, you can also follow us on Facebook at Saving with Steve Sexton, Insiders Club. You can see behind the scenes, guest gifts, the whole shot. And you know what? We are talking to Billy Spencer. He's a certified financial planner. He's a certified financial behavioral specialist. And you know what? It's financial planning month. So let's, you know what, start talking about having Billy walk us through the understanding of one's money mindset and how to develop better financial habits. So Billy, could you like help us understand that money mindset that people need to get to on a consistent basis? So, you know, and it can, how it can help them to help people develop a better financial habits there.
Sure. Yeah. So I think importantly, you know, money mindsets are so individual to each individual person. And I think the reason for that, which has been researched, is it really has to do just around like how we grew up around money and how we were socialized around it. And so if you think about it, like, if, you know, if I grew up in one area of the country versus somebody that grew up in a different area of the country, we're going to come to a situation with two potentially different money mindsets. And actually, you know, if you grew up with a sibling, like your sibling might have had an interaction around money that you had a similar one with, but you might have two completely different money mindsets, and it all has to do with how you grew up around money. So all that to say, it's shaped, money mindsets are really shaped in an earlier by family, by cultural and expectations about just like what, you know, gender and all those sorts of things around experiences. And so, for example, think of it this way. If, you know, going back to the 1930s and the Depression, if you grew up and, you know, you watched, you know, a parent or somebody go to the bank during the Depression and they weren't able to get their money out of it because it was literally no longer there anymore, you might actually grow fearful of banks and not want to put, you know, money into the bank. And because you grew up around that. So you might find yourself like keeping money in a shoebox or doing something like that. You also might find yourself like squeezing all the toothpaste out of the toothpaste tube, or like, you know, soap, and finding the best, like putting water into the soap and that sort of stuff, right? So that's one different money mindset. And then in a different way, some people might not have grown up that way. So it all just depends on all those different things. And how it works is, think of it sort of like a triangle, where there's an interaction with money that can create a belief, which then creates another action around money, which creates a belief, which then, you know, and think of it like the snowball going over time. And so when you get out into the world and you start working, like, you're coming to this with all these stories around money that have really shaped what your mindset is at that point.
Mm-hmm. So basically what you're saying, and we got mom and dad who are very frivolous with money, and you know what, you don't know why money's going out the door and all that stuff. You're spending on all sorts of things. And a lot of it has to do with the foundation of that was created when you were little.
It's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, it's money, you know, how you interact. Yeah, exactly.
And then when, you know what, if you're looking to break that mindset, what would be how would somebody go about doing just that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, it comes back to that awareness and thinking about like, is this mindset really useful for me anymore? And so that's where this like psychology and money integration really can come into play. Because if you find yourself, you know, doing something that feels sort of unhelpful around money, and you can't necessarily like break that cycle, like, just think about like, is this really serving me anymore? And if it isn't, you know, is there something I can do differently about it? A lot of this can come into play, especially around like spending and overspending and the use of credit cards, because it is so easy just to swipe your credit card and not necessarily understand what happened. And so if you can just, again, we were talking about earlier, like taking that pause in terms of purchasing, but again, thinking backwards and looking out into the future and saying like, okay, what is this something that I can do right, you know, future me wants me to do right now that I can go back to and make a small change with, and then just like start doing that. In the world, it's called solutions focused therapy. In that world, they actually have something called like the miracle question, where you can say to yourself, So, you know, imagine if you woke up tomorrow morning by some miracle overnight, you have been given everything you wanted in life and it's turned out just the way that you wished. What would you notice that would make you realize that miracle happened? Like, what would you be doing? What were the things that you'd see? How would you feel? Who would you be hanging out with? But what that can really do is kind of get you out of like that stuckness in terms of the money mindset and start thinking, you know, full peripheral of where you're at. And then help you sort of change that money mindset and get into the healthier financial habits that, you know, you want to be having. Because without understanding that awareness of everything, you can't really get there.
So, you know, for those people, the awareness portion of it, what are good tools for people that people can use to become more aware of their money and what they're spending and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you ask. There's so many different ways. And I think it really depends on like what people prefer. Some great tools are like, you know, any sort of integrated online, you know, budget tracking or finance tool that where you can aggregate your accounts and credit cards and kind of see everything in one place. Some people like spreadsheets, you know, different, your bank and your credit card company, they allow you to download things and you create your own sort of like budgeting spreadsheet. Some people like good old pen and paper. writing things down. And some people, you know, they like prefer using cash just because they can keep track of things. I think the thing with cash, which is really interesting, is you can hold on to it and you can see yourself sort of like giving the dollars out or taking the dollars back in. And that can really create more awareness around, you know, especially with like spending situations where if you're handing out all that money and you're actually seeing the physical money go away, it might make you think a little bit differently, like, oh, like maybe I didn't need to buy that thing.
No, I can see that because a lot of our viewers were saying, I've eliminated my debit cards, my ability to pay for things with my watch or my phone and my debit cards, and just gone to cash because I find out they spend less. They actually have created, like this one person, she goes, I created these envelopes and this is for food, this is for this, this is for this. She goes, but without it, she goes, I just spend. I don't know, have any idea what I'm spending. I mean, I could list it at the end of the month, and I tried doing that, but that doesn't work. So she just puts it in envelopes and says, okay, this one's for this, this one's for this, and once it's gone, it's gone. So it's real interesting because, yeah, the first month was kind of tough because I had to dip back in because of I went too many places in my car and spent too much on gas and stuff like that. So it's what you're really saying is you got to find your happy place to understand what you're spending and how to correct that mindset for yourself so you could stick with it.
Correct. And going back to your story about the cash, you could, I mean, people that don't want to do cash, like they could even do that online with like the use of different separate accounts. For example, like you could have one checking account that you just literally name, you know, household expenses, and you know, you just keep a set amount of dollars in there. And when you can see that going down compared to like the flexible spending account, which is more of like variable spending on things that you like to enjoy. And then, you know, with savings and different goals that you have, like if you want to go to Europe in 2027, what one thing that you can do that's really powerful is like literally open the account, title it, you know, Switzerland 2027, $10,000, and start saving money into that, or you know, keep $10,000 in there. Because once you see that and attach the trip to the name of the account, to the dollar amount, to the date, you kind of like lock that in there, and you're less likely to actually go in there and pull from that pot to go and spend it on something else if you see it there sitting there.
So that's wonderful. You know what? So what you're saying is, hey, if that's your goal, then you know what? Set aside an account just for that goal to achieve it. So if it's saving for a house, for a trip, a car, you know, if it's just daily spending, there's nothing wrong with having four or five accounts or six accounts. Just that way, if it keeps you in budget, and then you also have to have an account for saving and investing. So, what would be a good way for people to do that with like their payroll?
Yeah, so how I like to think about it, and you know, there's many different ways to go about it, but one that I like is setting up sort of like with payroll, doing direct deposits into fixed expenses, which are like the household expenses that don't necessarily change every single month. Variable expenses, which are more like the things that might change every single month, like you know, your trip to eat out or something like that. Like you don't necessarily have a set dollar amount per se every single month. And then a flexible account, which is, you know, something like that comes up every so often during the year, but you don't necessarily have it built into like a monthly budget. You know, for me, like that is my dog being groomed, right? Like that's every 6 weeks or so, and I don't necessarily need to like budget for it on a monthly basis. You know, I just want to make sure that there's money in that account to sort of pay for it. And so what you can do is set up payroll to do direct deposit into those three different accounts with the amounts that you need. And there, you know, that at that point, you kind of know what you can spend in each different spot. That also works very well with saving too. Going back to what I was saying before, is like create the, you know, have the retirement account, have the investment brokerage account that you're saving for, and have the savings account for the trip that you want to be taking. And try to, the best you can, automate all these different direct deposits into these places so that, you know, you kind of know where your money's going and know that it's working for you so that you don't necessarily have to think about it. So you can focus on the things you do want to be thinking about. Like it could be the money aspect of it, but if you don't want to be thinking about it, you then know that things are going in the right places and it's in order.
That's great. Hey, folks, that's wonderful advice from Billy Spencer. You're going to want to stick with us. We'll be right back with more Billy Spencer and Saving with Steve.
More expert advice for having a happier relationship with money still to come on the Saving with Steve Show.
Don't let your financial woes keep you up at night and prevent you from living a life of financial and personal freedom. Hi, I'm Steve Sexton, host of the Saving with Steve Show. We're going to be talking about the ins and outs of money, those financial issues that could be costing you thousands of dollars, causing stress, keeping you up at night. We're going to talk about money, tax reductions, saving more, spending less, your investments, risk management, retirement, and everything associated with you having a healthier, happy relationship with money. So if you've ever dreamed of living a life of financial and personal freedom, you owe it to yourself and your family to tune into the Saving with Steve Show. Join me, Steve Sexton, on the Saving with Steve Show as we talk about everything under the sun when it comes to money. To learn more about the show, visit savingwithsteve.us. That's savingwithsteve.us, savingwithsteve.us. We'll see you soon.
Welcome back to the show that is here to help you achieve your financial goals. It's the Saving with Steve Show. Now here's your host, Steve Sexton.
Hey, welcome back to the Saving with Steve Show. I truly thank you for tuning in and appreciate you letting your friends and families know about the Saving with Steve Show. Hey, again, all the replays are available at savingwithsteve.us. You do want to check out a few of our affiliates at UK Health Radio, BBS Radio, Talk Radio New York City, E360 TV, Las Vegas TV Network. All those networks are dedicated to empowering you to solve problems, uplift your spirit, and live a life of personal and financial freedom. Now, we are talking with Billy Spencer, certified financial planner. I love saying this, certified financial behavioral specialist. And you know what? What I'd like to start doing is, you know what? Here we are. We're moving into October here. We got November, December, and the year is almost over. One of the big things that people really don't pay attention to is taxes. We heard about the big, beautiful bill for those people at certain levels. They have as much as $6,000 or $12,000 extra, depending if they're married, for, you know, additional deductions, which is great. But you know what? We have a couple questions from our viewers that like to know, you know what? Hey, if I'm still working and I got a paycheck, you know, this person's actually, Julie's in her, you know, Julie, thank you. She's 52 years old. She's still working, but she wants to give to a charity. But she knows if she writes a check, it won't do anything for her because her standard deductions are, you know, this, the amount's so high. So what can she do, you know, if she's, you know, getting a payroll check to reduce her taxes if she's given to a charity?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the first thing I would think about if this person did have a taxable brokerage account and some investments is that you can actually, you know, start to think about how to give and give the most tax efficient way. Now, if this person isn't going to itemize on their tax return and get, you know, minimal benefit out of a contribution of writing a check to a charity, one strategy that people like to think about is what's called like a bunching contribution, where what you do is make use of what's called the donor advised fund. And I like to think of these as kind of like this little mini foundation for yourself that's administered by somebody else with less of the headache of actually having your own foundation and administering of it. But what you can do is you can actually donate, you know, cash or appreciated stock to it, and you get a tax deduction potentially in the year that you contribute to it. And then you can grant out funds over time, you know, and you know, sometimes there's a minimal amount you have to do at different places and sometimes there's not. But in this situation, what this person could do is sort of take stock of like, what is, you know, how much do I want to donate this year? What do I typically donate on an ongoing basis? And then maybe consider doing like 2, 3, 4, 5 years of gifts at once into that donor advised fund and bunch the contributions there. And then what they could do is then potentially, you know, itemize their tax deductions and then have money in that donor advised fund to then grant out to charities, you know, for each of the years out in the future until those funds run out.
Oh, okay. So that's a good option. Now, here's the next question. We have a few of our listeners that are over the age of 70. Sure. And they've been writing a check $500-$600 a month to a church. And you know what, here they are, they got standard deductions. They don't have anything really to deduct except for property taxes because everything else is covered. So what would be the way for them to eliminate income, reduce income, or just get a big tax reduction if they were looking to give to charities or their church?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for those who are of age and taking required minimum distributions, there is a tool, what's called a qualified charitable distribution, where you can actually donate up to, you know, a certain amount of, or, you know, it's right now, it's like $105,000 a year you can donate to charity. So they could donate potentially all of their required minimum distribution or a portion of it to their church or whoever they would like to donate it to. And what the benefit of that is that money that's coming out as a required minimum distribution is taxed at ordinary income rates, like a paycheck would be, which is less favorable. But then when you donate that money to charity, those dollars can actually be reduced from the amount of income that you're taking out of the IRA, which can benefit you from a tax perspective. That can work really well with those who are making relatively small donations and wouldn't get the benefit of like itemizing on their tax return. But it also can work really well for those with much higher required minimum distributions, because, you know, if they donate the entire amount they can contribute to charity with a qualified charitable distribution, that's a lot of ordinary income that's no longer on their tax return, which could benefit their tax situation, which then can impact other things like, you know, Medicare premiums and other sort of like modified adjusted income bracket related things on their tax return.
Now, the next question is going to come from our viewers, and it's really, this is in reference to Roth conversions.
Sure.
We have people who are, you know, they're under the age of 59 and a half. Can they do a Roth conversion without having to pay that extra 10% penalty if you take money out before 59 and a half?
Yes, they can do a Roth conversion. The thing is, though, is taking the money out of the Roth IRA.
Out of the IRA. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so you can do the Roth conversion itself. The sticky point is the, when you, if you need to take the money out of the Roth IRA itself, because that is where, there's different rules that apply to take the funds out of the Roth IRA. And so if you're under 59 and a half and you need the money from the IRA, not for a Roth conversion, like you might want to consider a different strategy. But if you say, like, let's say that you either were laid off and have a relatively low income year compared to what it could be into the future, or you retired early before 59 and a half and, you know, want to do some tax planning around, like, what should I do with my pre-tax funds, my 401k or my IRA? What you can do is do Roth conversion into that Roth IRA. And then once you get over 59 and a half, you know, if you've had the IRA open for 5 years, you can then start to take that money out tax-free. But if you haven't had that IRA open for 5 years and had the funds there for 5 years, then, you know, you can potentially get that penalty. It's all very situational. And so you really want to make sure that you're talking to a financial planner and tax advisor on those different things, because Roth conversions aren't necessarily for everybody, but they can be a really powerful planning tool when used well.
So here's the next question. When it comes to Roth conversions, what are the things that people should be considering? Because there's so much talk about doing the Roth conversions, especially with the big, beautiful bill. And, you know, even before that, there's all these advertisements that people are seeing, do the Roth conversion, talk to us, all that kind of stuff. What should people be looking at considering when they're doing a Roth conversion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I mentioned before, these Roth conversions can be a really powerful tool. The way that I like to think of it is more around, what's your tax bracket today? And what do you think your tax bracket is going to be in the future? That second part is a lot harder to determine because the future is so unknown with tax rates and all those sorts of things. And that's where, you know, planning around that can be super helpful. As I mentioned before in the previous question, you know, if let's say that you're still working, you're in a relatively high tax bracket, but, you know, you take a sabbatical or you stop working for a period of time and your income tax rate's lower. Like, that's a great example of when you might want to consider doing a Roth conversion, because if you're in the 12% tax bracket and your tax bracket in the future is going to be 37%, you know, try to fill up a couple of those different tax brackets until you get there. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, however, if you're in your peak earning years and, you know, a lot of your funds are not necessarily in like a retirement account, but they're in a taxable brokerage account, and so you don't have huge required minimum distributions to worry about into the future, making your income tax higher, when you retire, you know, at that point in time, like you're probably going to be in a lower tax bracket than what you would have been in when you were working. And so you could start to think about doing Roth conversions then. What's unique for those sorts of people, especially if like they're 63 and above, is like your income is going to start affecting your Medicare premiums when you hit 65 and all of that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of nuance to be playing around with this, which is why, again, it's super important to be working with a financial planner and a tax advisor who can help you think through some of this stuff.
So here's a question to follow along with that. And this is more of an age question. This comes from Colleen. Colleen, thank you for this. Colleen is actually 76 years old, life expectancy 91, 92. She goes, does it may really make sense for me to do a Roth conversion if I'm just doing it for myself? And she's got a multi-million dollar IRA and all that kind of stuff, but it's just like, what should I be looking at if I'm in my 70s to do a Roth conversion? Does it really make sense? And then I got a follow-up question to that for somebody else.
So obviously I don't know Colleen, but if I were talking to her, I'd like to think about like who else is in her sort of like network, like who are the beneficiaries of that IRA when she's no longer around? Because you want to be thinking not just with that individual person, but who is going to be receiving those funds into the future. And so I'll just in this example, I'll make something up. If Colleen had beneficiaries that were going to receive the IRA when they're in their peak earning years, and Colleen's in a a relatively lower tax bracket than them today, what they could be considering is like, okay, my kids that are going to be in their peak earning years are in the highest tax bracket. I'm sort of like in the middle of the road in terms of tax brackets. I could be thinking about doing some Roth conversions, so that when my children or my heirs inherit that Roth IRA, I'm not really like sticking them with a tax bill that they don't necessarily want, because those inheritors have to take funds out over a 10-year period and have that IRA depleted in 10 years at that point in time, which could create adverse tax effects for those beneficiaries.
This segment is really, really, really important because we've got a large number of people who are at that point where they're just about to retire, but they own a business. They're selling it. They spent 20, 30 years building up this business from nothing to something. And now they're looking at this big business going, oh my God, I gotta pay taxes. So Billy, the big question is, how can people get prepared to sell their business, number one? And number two, how should they start looking at the taxation or tax reduction?
First, I want to say congrats to these people who are nearing retirement and have a business to sell. That's wonderful. I think the most important thing to recognize is the best planning for this sort of event happened years prior. Which, if it hasn't happened, that's okay. But it's good to sort of build the team around you to start thinking about these different things, because there's different ways to structure your business depending on how you are going to sell it that can really benefit you from an income tax perspective. So, if you're going to transition the business to a family member, there are different estate and income tax planning tools to potentially sell the business to a family member through the use of different various trusts to help sort of like take advantage of the fact that that business isn't necessarily super marketable, and you can potentially sell it at a lower valuation, or than what you might get on the market for that sort of thing. Likewise, if this is a specific type of business that qualifies for what's called qualified small business stock or QSBS, there's potential if this is a C corp, and there's a number of different nuances in terms of qualifying for this sort of thing. But they could actually potentially sell that business and actually shelter $15 million or up to 10 times their basis, which is a could be an
Oh,
astronomical amount
wow.
of money hidden from taxation, if planned for properly. This is the sort of thing where, like I said, there's a lot of nuance, and you want to make sure that you are measuring twice, or maybe even like 10 times, and cutting this sort of thing just to make sure that you save on the taxes. But I do think, just in general, like I said, like the planning for this sort of thing does happen, well in advance, hopefully, of the business actually being sold. But then also too, like there's the income tax piece of it, but thinking about the business and selling, like what's next for them? you know, because that could actually dictate some of the advice. Because if you know, if they're charitable, for instance, they could potentially, you know, donate shares of their business to charity, and that could help them from an income tax planning perspective on the sale of the business. They could be gifting shares of the business to their children, like I said before, and setting it up that way, which, you know, could also help out with income tax planning. And then also too, if there's going to be a very large capital gain or some income that's being generated from the business, like how do you plan around that? And there are many tools at the disposal to sort of do that sort of thing. I already mentioned one, qualified small business stock, you know, donating to charity. But it all comes back to just thinking about like, what is it that I, that how, you know, how does this sort of business sale fit into my life and what do I want to do next? Because that's going to dictate the best approach to go about it.
Okay, so for example, if somebody's looking to sell the business and use that, the proceeds to create an income, they might want to hold a note so they can actually get the interest and the capital gains that they get from holding the note for the sale of the business, which would defer taxation, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, even doing something as simple as an installment sale to kind of spread the taxation of the gains out over a period of years. Because, you know, rather than having it all happen at once, you could potentially spread that out. And with that too, you know, to your point, like having an install, like having the note, like you can actually receive some income, some interest income from holding the note while you wait to receive all the, you know, different installment payments from the sale.
Okay. And then one person wrote in and says, hey, he has an employee stock option plan. Okay. He's now receiving this. And it's one of those situations where they're going to be receiving a lump sum every single year for the next 5 years. And this lump sum is like $900,000. So how do they deal with something like that from a taxation standpoint?
Yeah, that's a good one. And I think it has to do with the entire like financial system of this person and thinking about like how do we effectively receive that money but keep more of it in our pocket at that point in time. And so if that sale is coming to you, like what are the tools at your disposal to reduce your income? If they're still working, you know, simple things like continue to max out a retirement plan or saving into different deferred vehicles like a health savings account and things like that, that could help with the ordinary income aspect of it. The flip side with the capital gains is if this person's charitable, can they donate appreciated stock from another part of their savings portfolio to charity to get the tax benefit and other things like that?
I see. Are there any type of like tax deductible oriented investments that people can utilize to offset taxation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, something for especially real estate investors, there's the use of like 1031 exchanges, which is essentially like, you can defer the gain on a property to another one, if you know done right, and you have to make sure that you work with a you know an attorney and an intermediary and that sort of thing to sort of like continue the gains on and kick those gains can even down the road a little bit, do that sort of thing. There's also you know other different sort of funds that you can contribute, like large appreciated stock positions to, which is called like an exchange fund, where there's a different lockup period and that sort of thing, where you have to keep your money there. I think the thing with those sorts of tools at your disposal, you really have to sit down and think like, is the juice worth the squeeze to get the tax benefit of doing that? Because you know, if you're going to sell your business and you need every single dollar that that business sale is going to generate to really fund a comfortable like retirement or whatever's next for you and that sort of thing, like the last thing we would want to see you do is sort of like create some illiquidity by putting it somewhere else and paying fees for that sort of thing when you actually needed it yourself. And so that's where, you know, when I think about business planning, it's the tax piece, it's the estate planning and the attorney's piece of it, but it's also like the personal piece of it and just making sure like, does all this planning actually make sense for who I am and what I need from this business sale? And then applying that to, you know, the strategies that are available.
So, Billy, could you spend a few minutes just talking about what you do at Crestwood Advisors and how you help people, and maybe even share some of your information so people, if they'd like to get in contact with you, they could.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. So, I'm a wealth manager at Crestwood Advisors. And so we work with, you know, high net worth, some ultra high net worth individuals. Primarily, you know, these are first generational wealth folks. Like I think our average client's like somewhere between, you know, 55 and 65. Typically like still working or getting close to that point in time when they're no longer working. And, you know, we lead with financial planning and think about, you know, what are the sorts of strategies you can do to help this person achieve the life that they want. And we, you know, we work intergenerationally too. You know, a lot of the clients that we work with who might be that pre-retired, re-age, like we end up working with their parents and their children, just because all of this is all part of one, you know, big financial system that is our client. And working with all these different people, we can provide a lot better advice. So like I said, we do financial planning and investment management. I'm a wealth manager. I've been here for about 10 years and we're located in Boston, but we work.
Okay, great. So if somebody wants to get a hold of you, how do they go about doing that, Billy?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. You know, I'm Billy Spencer on LinkedIn. My email is wspencer, W-S-P-E-N-C-E-R at crestwoodadvisors.com. And yeah, I mean, I'm mostly active on LinkedIn. You can email me anytime and hit me there.
Okay. Hey, Billy, I want to thank you for sharing this information with us today. You've said a lot of things that people have been asking about, and I really appreciate you asking those questions, even though I didn't have to ask them, which is great. again, I want to thank you for being here. So folks, with that, I want to thank you all for joining us today right here on Saving with Steve. Look forward to speaking with you next week, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for the Saving with Steve show, hosted by Steve Sexton. To learn more about the show and how to become a guest or sponsor, visit savingwithsteve.us. That's savingwithsteve.us. Join us again next time as we continue to talk about everything under the sun that relates to you having a healthier, happier relationship with money. This has been the Saving with Steve show, hosted by Steve Sexton.